Okay, can everybody hear me? You ready to go? Sorry for me being late. I guess there's other challenges too. Anyway, Jen, like to welcome everyone to the BCDC ECRB meeting. The Engineering Criteria Review Board. This meeting will be recorded, so everybody knows that. Okay, good afternoon. Welcome to this hybrid meeting of the Engineering Criteria Review Board, ECRB, of the BCDC. My name is Jim French. I'm the acting chair today of the ECRB because our regular chair, Rod, has been recused for this particular project. I'd like to announce that we also have a new board member, new ECRB member, Patrick Ryan, structural engineer and a principal of Ryan Joyce Structural Design. And Ryan's not here, right? He's recused, I know, but he didn't show up anyway. So we look forward to working with Patrick in the future. Also recused today is board member, board alternate Dilip Trivedi. Our first, oh, and our chair is recused, Rod Iwashita. Our first order of business is to call the roll. Board members, please unmute yourselves to respond and then mute yourselves again after responding. Jen?
I'm going to call off everybody's name, even if you know they're not here today. So I'll start with Rod Iwashita, chair of the board. I know he's not here today since he was recused. Jim French, vice chair of the board, today's chair.
Present.
Bob Battaglio.
Present.
Bill Holmes.
Present.
Jima Casale.
Present.
Chris May. I know Chris wanted to be here, but she was sick. Ramin Golsorki.
Present.
Nick Sitar.
Here.
Gail Johnson.
Present.
Talia Trivasaru. She was not going to show up today. Dilip Trivedi. We mentioned he was recused. Justin Vandiver.
Present.
And Patrick Ryan, he's recused. We have eight board members present, Jim. That's correct. The quorum is five.
This will be louder then. Sorry. I'll keep going then. Second, if you're attending on Zoom platform, please raise your virtual hand in Zoom. If you're new to Zoom and you joined our meeting using the Zoom application, click the hand at the bottom of your screen and the hand should turn blue, I think, or maybe different color on different platforms. Third, if you're joining our meeting via phone, press *9 on your keypad to raise your hand to make a comment. We will call on individuals who have raised their hands in the order they are raised during the public comment period for each project, well, one project today. Every now and then I might refer to the meeting host, Grace, who is working behind the scenes to ensure that the technology moves forward smoothly and consistently. Please be patient with us as needed. Next, ex parte communications as set forth in BCDC's regulations. A member of the ECRB shall not have any oral or written communications regarding a proposed project or other matter that has been noticed to be considered at the ECRB meeting with a project proponent, permit applicant, prospective applicant, or member of the public, except on the record during an ECRB meeting. Board members, in case you have inadvertently forgotten to provide our staff with a notice on any written or oral ex parte communications, I invite members who have engaged in any such communications to report on them at this point by raising your hand and unmuting yourself. For the record, no hands have been raised. Okay. Second agenda item, public comment period on items not on the agenda. We have set a time, set aside time now for hearing public comment on items related to BCDC policies or permits that are not explicitly on the agenda. Do we have anyone present or online who would like to make a comment not related to the planned project for the India Basin Shoreline Project? No hands online and no hands in person here either. Okay, thanks. Agenda item 3, staff updates. Now we'll have a staff update from Jen.
Thank you, Chair French. I would like to provide an update to the board on a few items. ECRB meeting dates have been set for 2024 and are posted on the BCDC website. And I've started to send out meeting invitations to board members so you can reserve that time on your calendar. Regarding upcoming ECRB meetings, there are currently no projects right now scheduled for the meetings in 2024, but please keep these dates open on your calendar since there are some applicants we know will need to return to the ECRB, in particular Cargill Salt and also San Francisco International Airport are gonna schedule second meetings, a follow-up meeting in the new year. Lastly, I wanted to let the board members know that BCDC has updated the policy regarding the role that ECRB members can play as consultants to permit applicants. Board members are no longer allowed to represent permit applicants before the ECRB. Board members who have been recused for assisting permit applicants are not allowed to speak to the board in a presentation or answer questions while being paid by the applicant. Recused board members may attend meetings in person or remotely as a member of the public. If they do want to speak as a member of the public, they may, as long as they are not being compensated by the applicant. Do board members have any questions about this? Okay, great. That's all I have, Jim, for announcements.
Thanks, Ben.
Let me do that over again. Sheesh, sorry about that. Okay, with a microphone on this time. Before we move on to the presentation proper, are there any announcements from board members? No hands raised. So we will move on to the presentation. The India Basin Shoreline Park, the discussion and presentation will follow. The meeting will proceed according to the following agenda. First, Jen Hyman, senior engineer from BCDC, will make a short presentation on the project, followed by the presentation by the application team, by the applicant team. During the presentation, it's fine for board members to ask short clarifying questions or have limited discussion, but the primary discussion will follow later. At the end of the presentation, we'll open the meeting for public comments related to engineering issues in the presentation. After hearing any comments from the public, the ECRB will resume the discussion with their questions and comments. And at the end of the discussion, I'll ask for final comments and any motions, and then close our consideration of the project. At this time, I would like to ask board members and other participants to please turn on your cameras when you're speaking or actively engaged with the discussion. When you're not actively engaged with the discussion, please turn off your cameras so that we minimize distractions on screen and possibly bandwidth issues as well. I now ask Jen to provide the introduction to the project.
Good afternoon, Chair French and members of the Engineering Criteria Review Board. My name is Jen Hyman, and I'm the senior engineer at BCDC and secretary of the ECRB. This will be the board's first review of the India Basin Shoreline Park project. I have some background information on the project to share with you first. There we go. We already went over the meeting agenda. Let me share with you a little bit about India Basin Shoreline Park. India Basin Shoreline Park is located just north of Hunters Point and Candlestick Park and just south of Mission Bay and Heron's Head Park in the southeast corner of San Francisco. There is an existing park there that is being completely renovated. San Francisco Department of Recreation Parks has submitted pre-application materials to BCDC and has had a meeting with the Design Review Board. The adjacent 900 Innes Avenue project is a separate concurrent project, also with extensive new public access features. The Indian Basin Shoreline Park project is designed to renovate the entire park based on extensive community input. It includes two new full-size basketball courts and a cookout terrace. It also includes new water-oriented activities, including boating and wading, which are the focus of this meeting, and also provides sea level rise resiliency to the park. Today's meeting of the ECRB is focused on the engineering design of two structures that are in the bay. The first is the boathouse pier and intermediate landing of the new boating dock. These two piling-supported structures are connected by gangways and lead to a floating dock for launching kayaks. The second item of discussion is the South Marine Way Wall. This is a 165-foot long concrete walkway. It's about 10 to 12 feet wide on top, and it holds up the new gently sloped beach and is also designed to allow the public to walk on top of it down to the end of the water. The design issues, which will be explained shortly in the presentation by the applicant's team, include challenging geology, including undocumented fill and highly compressible clays below the fill, seismically active region leading to strong ground shaking and liquefaction of soil layers, wind and wave loads, potential impacts from construction of a flat concrete wall in the bay, and sea level rise. So questions I put together for the board to consider as they hear the presentation today are: one, are the scenarios and design criteria in the stability analyses for the piers and the South Marine Way wall appropriate for the site hazards, site conditions, and site criticality? Two, are potential hydrodynamic impacts from the South Marine Way wall a concern? Three, are future coastal flooding concerns from sea level rise addressed adequately in the park design? Four, is there any data monitoring you recommend BCDC require the applicant to enhance the future safety of the project in light of its projected 40-year estimated design life? And lastly, five, are there any design and physical concerns that have not been addressed? Now we will hear the presentation from the applicant team.
Okay, thank you. So hello, I'm Catherine Liss from GGN. We're the landscape architect and design lead on this project, India Basin Shoreline Park. I just wanna thank you all for taking the time to review this on behalf of our design team and project partners. So just quickly, these are the project partners and the team that will be speaking today. So as I noted, I'm from GGN, and then Sean Hart from Moffitt Nickel and Cameron from AGS will also be speaking. I will provide a brief overview, very similar to what Jen just went through, and then I'll hand it over to Sean and Cameron to go through the technical and engineering elements. So as noted, we are located on the southeast corner of San Francisco, right on the bay. Zooming in on the image on the right, we're also located along the Bay Trail. That's that purple line that's winding its way through, connecting basically PG&E directly to the north with the future 900 Innes project once it's constructed to the south. And then this is a view of the existing site. It is an existing park, India Basin Shoreline Park, outlined in the dashed black line that you see there. It's a park that really is underutilized and needs some renovation, and specifically focusing along the shoreline, you can see in image number three in the bottom right-hand corner, we do have a riprap protection there right now, but it is in disrepair and is still showing signs of erosion even with that protection there. So as noted, I will now hand it over to Cameron and Sean to go through these three key elements of our design from the engineering standpoint.
Thank you so much, Catherine. I'm Cameron Gyasi with AGS. AGS has done geotechnical investigation in two phases for this project. On phase one, we focus on 900 Innes site, and on phase two, we supplement our work in 900 Innes and also did the India Basin. In phase one, we performed 10 test pits, 4 soil boring, and 7 CPTs. And on phase two, we did 14 additional onshore boring to depth ranging between 8 to 100 feet, 5 offshore boring, to also depth of the
I apologize for the delay. We lost our Wi-Fi here in the meeting room we're in, and it just came back. So we'll be restarting the presentation.
Yes, so we perform geotechnical investigation in two phases. In phase one, we focus on 900 INES site with 10 test pit, 4 soil boring, and 7 CPTs. And phase two, we combine the India Basin project as well as the 900 INES, and we perform additional 14 borings, 9 CPTs, and also the 8 of them was onshore and 5 of them was offshore. On one of the borings, we also perform PS suspension downhole logging for the geophysical to determine the shear velocity of it. As in total, we did 29 borings, which 24 of them was offshore and 5 of them offshore, 9 CPTs, 10 test pits there. 8 of the boring was focused on this area that we have these two structures which are concerned with the BCDC, which 4 of them was offshore and 4 of them was onshore. And also we did 3 CPTs in there. As a summary, we had a very very complex subsurface conditions. We had some area we had undocumented fill. The fill was very heterogeneous, and the depth thickness of it was ranging between nothing from 0 to 41 feet in some area. Underneath of it, typically we had young bay mud, which with the thickness of the between 0 to 77 feet. Below Young Bay Mud, we encounter interbedded sand and clay sometimes, and the thickness of it ranges between 0 to 30 feet. And below that is Old Bay Clay with the thickness of the 0 to 20 feet, and then colluvium or residual soil between 0 to 20 feet, and then the bedrock which we encounter. Most of our borings in offshore and near the shoreline reach the bedrock there. Groundwater ranges from 9 to 22 feet below ground surface. The ground surface at those locations, the elevation of it was plus 5 to plus 13 feet with NAVD 88. Next slide, please. Soil parameters were developed by the information from the field and the lab. Most of it was developed by either published relationship or guidelines from the public agencies there. Residual under shear strain parameter for liquefiable soil was determined from correlation with the N160. As suggested originally by Seed and then later by other researchers like Kramer and Wang in 2015. And for the bedrock, we estimated the module of the elasticity by a relationship between that with unconfined compressive strength of the rock. And conservatively, we use 100 for the ratio there.
Cameron, I have a quick question, I guess pretty obvious maybe, but effective unit weights, I assume that's when it's below the groundwater table, right? But above the groundwater table, your effective unit weights will be
much higher.
60,
yes.
50
yes.
pounds heavier, 60 pounds heavier.
Correct. These okay. are only.
So in your stability and all that, you actually you didn't use 62
that,
for.
That is correct. Then. Next slide, please. This plate shows the distribution of our borings and CPTs and test pits. As you can see, we try to characterize the site by going along the proposed structures as well as the other places that we are planning to place fill to determine settlements and other geotechnical considerations there. Also, we perform slope stability analysis along 9 cross sections. Those cross sections are shown by green arrows there. And also we develop 7 generalized subsurface profile, which are showing with the dark blue lines in there. Next, please. So this is one of the cross sections near the proposed 2 structures that is concerned for the BCDC. As you can see, these are very generalized, but the materials are relatively heterogeneous. They pinch out in some area, and then the artificial fill is actually pretty thick in some in the onshore portion of that. Next one. This is the generalized geological cross section along the profile EE prime. And you can see that in this one, we don't have some of the subsurface material are missing, like interbedded sand and clay is missing, and or old bay clay is missing in some area. And the artificial fill was directly on top of the bedrock. And then the thickness of the bay mud was also varies significantly there. Next slide. This is also another one along this more or less the same area. That's also you can see that some of the thicknesses are variable and some layers are missing in that section there, according to our boring logs there. And the next one. So we determines some major geotechnical considerations that affecting the project. Because of the placing the beach, one item would be static settlement. And also due to this settlement also can be due to the undocumented fill and highly compressible clay below the fill. We also have seismically induced deformation due to the potential liquefiable soil and loose unsaturated soil above and below the groundwater, both for the fill and also the sand lenses below the Young Bay Mud. We also have a strong ground shaking like everywhere else in Bay Area. And we also have some ground movement due to earthquake-induced slope failure there. Next slide, please. Following the procedure in ASC 716 and also ASC 4117, we developed seismic criteria. For the 900 INES, we have some structure which they remain in place. So that's why we use the ASC 4117. But for the other project, other part of the project and the new structures we use, we follow the ASC 716 there. Next one, please. So based on the site information that we had, we classified the subsurface condition to 2 site classification, One of them was D with the shear velocity, average shear velocity of about 1,000 feet per second. And then one of them, of course, would be F because of the presence of the liquefiable soil there and collapsible soil there. We site-specific acceleration was developed following ASC 716 for 50 years return period, and the PGAM of the 0.78 and 0.65 was determined or calculated for onshore and offshore part there. Maximum moment magnitude of the 8.05 for San Andreas fault, which is the governing fault for this site. And then we also use the design seismic criteria by multiplying it by 2/3 of the MCA level there. For the liquefaction analysis, also we use a moment magnitude of the 8.05 with the PGAM of the 0.78G. No depth limit was applied. Thin layer transition, was applied for the CPT logs there. We also used the clay-like and sand-like method as proposed by Bollinger and Idris. And then groundwater level was as the highest point of plus 8 feet for the onshore and zero for the offshore level there. For assumptions that we did for liquefaction-induced lateral deformation, we were looking at the continuity of the layers, making sure that because this liquefaction that we calculate was very localized in some area, because of this field was very heterogeneous in some areas that a lot of the gravels, rocky materials, and in some area they had young behemoth and that it was mixed with the field. And in some area was just sand and clay there. So we were looking at the continuity of that layer to determine if the lateral deformation can occur. And then the free face, we apply the free face condition for it. And then we use the lateral displacement index method to calculate the liquefaction induced lateral deformations there. Next slide. For the Moraine Walk project, there is going to be some beach level and some raising the grade there. So to provide a support for this fill, originally a retaining wall was considered, but that it was very difficult to come up with the design due to liquefiable soil and the young thickness of the young behemoth there. Therefore, instead, we decided to use a MSC embankment for supporting that engineered fill, and that MSC by itself is going to be supported by the DSM. Because of the bay mod that we have in there is a very highly compressible, we estimated the settlement could be on the order of the several feet over many years. And therefore, we wanted to improve that soil by constructing the deep soil mixing there. And we develop some plans for it, and we try to keep that as a performance-based approach that specified maximum design bearing capacity of the treated young behemoth of the 20 PSI for a dead plus live load. Next slide. This is a cross-section along the pier, and you will see that we have a young behemoth, which is going to be treated. And underneath of it, we have bedrock, essentially there. So all the DSM are going to be extending to the entire length of the young behemoth, goes to the bedrock. And we are using hopefully the lime to improve that one there. And above that, above the DSM will be MSC wall that we are going to place it there. Next one, please. The MSC wall was considered to be the most cost-effective solution for that. So to provide the support for the marine way beach or field and walkway slab there. Again, performance-based approach was selected to specify minimum safety factor against sliding, creep, and constructions. Next slide, please. So these are showing several sections of the MSC and then DSM wall there. To have a facet for the wall, we try to stay, provide a gap between the MSC and the facial wall there. And then the MSC has, in one side, has up to 70 degree angle, and the other side has about 45 angle there. It's going to be all wrapped in the geogrid and also with the filter fabric inlaid inside of it there to make sure that we have a proper drainage as well as the support there. Next one. So by that, I'm going to pass it to Sean.
Thanks. Thank you. All right. Moving on. So I guess this slide shows the items that we're considering during this meeting. So you can see the pier and the intermediate landing on the left that are pile supported. And then on the right, that red line that kind of curls around, that's the Marine Way walkway that has a, like Cameron just said, has a MSC structure that's retaining and a cast in place concrete fascia wall in front for erosion really concerns, really more than anything else. So I've listed the design criteria items here in the table to the right. I think most of those are fairly self-explanatory. I guess we're concentrated on the piers and the pile supported structures first, but dead, live, we're not considering our wave and current loads aren't going to govern on these structures. No berthing loads would have to be a very shallow ship. Wind loads, not going to govern seismic loads. We are designing this per ASC 61. Category is low and based on low importance. And we're using a 2/3 MCER, like Cameron spoke before, and all that spectrum was developed by AGS. And I think an important one, keep going. We can go next. Yep. All right. So this is just kind of the method, ASC 61 method that we use. We used a pushover analysis in 16 different directions with 100% plus 30% to account for torsional items. And then we calculate the displacement demand for the design earthquake for each pushover curve. So, and then we're using life safety as the limit state for the hinges, which is another important criteria. And we have in the table over here on the bottom right, we have the strain limits that apply for the life safety criteria, both for above ground hinges in the piles and below ground hinges. No requirements for deep in ground for the life safety protection item criteria. So perform joint shear, I think we could go to the next slide. It's basically AFC 61. So this is kind of a snapshot of what the SAP finite element model looks like. We developed PMM hinges, which I think I've talked about briefly on the next slide. The soil springs that are along the piles were developed with the help of AGS, and the tables that are on this slide kind of tell you the layering that was assumed for the location of these two structures. So we have the intermediate landing that's in the darker green, and then the pier that's in yellow. A note to be made is that I assumed that what was liquefiable was liquefied during the analysis. So it's already in the liquefied state, right? So the fill that could liquefy, we just assumed it was liquefied. I think you can go.
Sean, I have a quick question. Sure. I think, let me see if I can get my video going again. How are you imposing these springs here? Do you have deformation from the geotech that pushes against the back of the springs, and that's what's pushing against?
No, we are calculating a displacement demand with a substitute structure method, and so. Yeah, so we get a displacement requirement, and then we're checking. So we're forcing it, and then getting.
And how are you comparing what's actually going to push on that from the soil?
What's going to push? Well, we aren't getting what's going to push on it from the soil. There's no loads from the soil.
So we determined that there was no lateral spread loading from it, if that's what you meant by that.
Okay.
That's, yeah.
Because of the discontinuity that exists between the liquefiber layers there.
Okay, gotcha.
This is just a basic extract analysis to get plastic moments. We're using expected values for the materials to get hinge capacities, which are in that little box on the left. I think you can go to the next slide. This is one of the cases, case A1, that shows the hinges in the pile, the above ground hinges. There, you can see them as green dots. And then the below ground hinge in below ground at the maximum moment location. I think you could go to the next slide. This is an elevation view of the different structures. I think it kind of gives you a good idea of what's going on otherwise. So you have the boathouse pier that's on the top. You arrive from the boathouse and there's like a walkway. I believe is also pile supported, but it's not part of this meeting. Then you transition onto the boathouse pier. There's two gangways that connect the boathouse pier to the intermediate landing, and then the intermediate landing to a float system is another gangway. I think you can go to the next slide. These are some basic structural details for those two pile supported elements. Concrete, there's going to be a wood deck on top. I don't think that makes much difference to us today. And go to the next slide. Basic detail for a reinforced concrete pile. Go to the next slide. Okay, so now we are over to the marineway wall. So as Cameron discussed previously, I know the text is a little small on the detail on the top left, but you can see the trapezoid of MSC and that's there. And then below that is DSM, the cross hatch. And then we have some engineered fill in the back of all that. And there's the gravel beach, which is a fill and back that or on top of that. And the concrete fascia panel is sitting in the front of all of those items with a void between it and the MSE. And the purpose of the void is we're trying to disconnect from the MSC. So any lateral translation of the MSC won't load the wall. We were asked to talk about the concrete wall will have a textured surface. It's e-concrete, I guess, is what the proprietary brand is, but it's a textured surface that promotes marine growth. The picture below is a picture I took last week out at Pier, I think it's 45 over by Fisherman's Wharf, where they have the port has these test panels that they hung. So the comparison is on the top, there's a sheet pile wall, and that's the amount of growth that you're getting. And the bottom is the e-concrete panel, which looks to have more growth, though it's qualitative.
There you go.
Okay. So I want to know a little bit more about the scar protection apron that you were talking about. I mean, what's the extent of that?
Here's a cross section, so you can kind of see the ball, 8 feet wide. 8 feet wide.
Okay. Is this supported on the DSM system?
It is not supported. So the idea is that they're going to excavate a small pocket, which I believe they're putting the fabric down. Essentially, the DSM is going to stand up.
Okay.
Can you repeat what he said?
Oh, he said that the DSM is going to extend 4 to 5 feet in front of the wall.
What about the scour protection?
It's 8 feet wide, right?
Okay, can I follow up and just, what size wave is being assumed for that? Because that sounds very small. I can point to real problems with, because you have a solid wall and the wave impact goes straight down and it will rip 5 to 8 inch carpal right out. That's not rock of any significance actually when it comes to wave action. So I would strongly suggest that somebody look at the size of the waves and make sure that this is in fact adequate. But just kind of on looking at it, it doesn't look adequate. And since we're at it, there is the other issue. I'm not sure why you're so worried about separating the wall from the mechanically stabilized embankment behind. But we have plenty of examples, City of Pacifica specifically, where the waves come in, go right behind the wall, mm-hmm. and rip the panels out from behind. The point being that you really have to have, if there is going to be a gap, it has to be really carefully sealed or protected from direct water entry. And the other thing is that since you're talking, my understanding is geogrid and a wrap, that there be again erosion protection, basically a fabric around the wrap, so there is no opportunity for basically erosion should the MSC wall get saturated by, you know, things happen. So extra protection, and that's not a very difficult thing to do.
Let's try and keep these comments for now. Okay, it's short, right. Clarifying on the ballot of work.
Okay, mine's working.
Okay.
Is it possible to have Mads on?
Yeah, I was trying to get Mads to kind of take over for the next slide, but.
Yes, I apologize. I had a sequence just before we got to this point where I lost audio. I could see the slides moving on. But I could speak to the size of the stone or the rock for the scour apron, we did look at that and we sized that to be appropriate. So the condition in the bay there is that it's really a mud flat at low tide. A large extent of the bay is dry and it's mud flat. So very, very flat, shallow pan coming up to these structures. So in many cases of intermediate tide conditions, the waves coming in are going to be depth limited. So there's a certain size they can get to and they start breaking. And then for a more severe case of storm surge and waves coming in, there's considerably deeper water along these wall structures. But we have sort of considered the envelope of these exposures as we sized the stone for the scour apron.
All right, thanks. I guess, should we continue on with the slides? Yeah. Mads, can you speak to the sea level rise analysis? And
Yeah. So I don't know if this slide has been presented earlier, but the table on the left summarizes all the different tidal datum planes that exist at the site. That's the upper part of the table. And the lower portion has the storm water levels with tide up to the 100-year return period water level at the bottom row. The table below that then has the tidal planes projected with future sea level rise. And this is assuming the OPC medium to low risk aversion, medium to high risk aversion projection, which is a pretty conservative sea level rise projection to apply to this kind of project. It puts us on the safe side of things. And site features are generally at elevation plus 15 NABD 88. So we've evaluated the risk of exposures to sea level rise for future projected conditions and finding that the site is basically resilient to sea level rise through mid-century and going towards end of century. King tides would not be a concern until around the time 2070 or thereafter. So in terms of public access, features, the site is resilient through 2050 and beyond.
I have a question. Chair, can I ask you a question?
I had a quick question.
Sorry, I got that turned on, but wrong one. What's the design life of the project? Jen said in her introduction that it was 40 years. 40 years plus now is 2065, which I don't see down here. You have a bunch of other things. What is it that's our actual target?
2070?
I had the same question. Where did the 40 years come from? It's a funny number.
So what is the design life of the project?
40 to 50 years. I mean, design life is, 40 to 50 years. That's what my understanding
is. So 40 to 50 years, so 2075-ish or something like that, 2070.
I mean, how is that established? Does that come from the owner or the city?
I don't actually know that. We decided on how long was reasonable. I mean, I think that's some of it is, you know, some of these elements obviously will last longer than that. But I think that was a reasonable projection.
I thought it was for the piers. It was a reasonable. Yeah.
Oh, That's a different
problem. Yeah, for the piers, I thought that was the reasonable projection from, like...
You're talking about when they have to move for adaptation?
I'm just talking about for the structural design life of the structure.
Yeah, I mean, that's reasonable. I mean, they can last longer, but I mean, there's plenty of piers in San Francisco that are over 100 years old.
In fact, most structures are assumed to have a design life longer than 40 years. That's why I'm wondering where it came from. It's a funny number. It's a very short number.
It should be based on the lifespan of the materials used to construct a project.
Well, it should be based upon whoever's paying for this wants it to be. I mean, it's not usually made up by the design team, in my experience. Someone says, I want this to be, so long. Mm-hmm.
We can double check on that. I'm David Froelich from Reckon Park, City of San Francisco. And it may have been established as a departmental number, 40 to 50 years, based on material life. And then we reevaluate and would see if it needs to be renovated.
And so what have you been, you have been working as if it is 40 to 50 without quite knowing exactly how that was established. Okay, so everything you've done so far, everything you're presenting here is based on a 40 to 50 years.
Bob, did you have something else?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Thank you. I was looking at the coastal engineering report, I think it was, and it showed, I think figure 5 and/or 6 showed that the pier at the India Basin Shoreline Park to the float, the lower pier deck. There's a first pier, then a ramp, and then a lower pier, and then a ramp to the float. So that lower pier is underwater at 2050, I guess, during the 100-year event, or the 1% annual chance. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, this is getting very complicated. Thanks for reminding me. So I just wanted to clarify that. I guess we can have a discussion later. And I think that's because of access. So I think I understand that, but I just wanted to get that out there. And then I have a question which may or may not be in your presentation, but since I'm talking, and may also be to Jen. I'm really interested in the motions of the floats and what the programming is for the multiple floats. Mm-hmm. And the public safety associated with that. And I don't know that was in our requested review, but I would like to hear about it if that's okay. You know, basically what kind of motions do you expect on the public access floats, and what's their programming? Are you gonna have commuter ferries or just, small boats, or what's happening? So I just, however you want to finish your presentation, but if somebody could address that, I would really appreciate it. Thank you.
Should we finish the presentation first, or do you want to?
Well, I think we can just address that.
Yeah, go ahead.
If you want to talk about the wave component of it, and then I can start with the program. So in terms of the program, the main feature is the reason why it has to go out this far is, again, because it's such a shallow bay. And so we need that distance to get basically to make the stock as usable as possible. I think we're trying to get it to about 95% usable. So like 5% of the time at like very extreme tides, it wouldn't be, it would be kind of grounded, but at that 95%, we're getting enough water underneath so that it can be usable. And it's for very shallow watercraft or human-powered watercraft, I guess. So like kayaks or small boats that you can kind of paddle up to. And there's a portion of the dock that's actually a lower freeboard dock than the rest of it, which you can kind of see on this top image here. So there's actually the very end of it is about a 20 by 20 area that is just 2 picnic tables. And that's how high off the water?
It's a low freeboard dock. I think it's... we're going for something like 4 or 5 inches. So the rest is higher, like 14 or 16, or I forget the number.
So that upper portion, that 20 by 20, would be that upper higher distance away from the water. And that's just, you know, meant to be for everyone to kind of come and enjoy the kind of the end of the floating dock. You know, you could gather there, you could have kind of a lunch spot. And then again, that other, actually, yeah. So that other portion is that lower portion that has the kayaks. And then also on the other side, there's an accessible component. It's like an accessible access for kayaks. So you can kind of get on and off accessibly. That's the program question.
Yeah.
Thank you. And that makes sense to me. And it's consistent with what I was looking at. But on the access or the programming, there is another pier. And I think this is still under our review. And I thought I read in a report that something about ferries could dock on either side. Is that the 700 or the 900 Innes?
No.
There's not enough water.
No, yeah.
They have to be like hovercrafts. Yeah.
Well, okay. Thank you. Yeah, and I did read it. So I might have been in an older, I think it was the older report, Hoffman and Nickel report on coastal. I'll look again while we're on. Maybe it was my mistake, but I wouldn't have said that unless I thought I read it anyway.
So just to clarify, there are three projects in the area. 900 Innes is phase two of this project that's being built right now. So there is a adjacent project next door. That's the 700 Innes project, and that's being developed by Build Developers. It's a separate project. So
that's where I probably read that. Okay. And we're not reviewing that project.
Not.
Okay. Correct. All right. Thank you. My mistake. So thank you for that programming information. My specific concern, which we can discuss later, and I'd like to hear your take on it, is the structural loading. Look at a 2.7 foot wave at a 50 year recurrence wind wave. And I'm just interested in how the floats that are publicly accessible with, you know, picnic tables, whatever, will respond to that wave action. What kind of float motion is anticipated? And then, which raises, you know, maybe a question about safety for, you know, the general public and maybe some management of access to that. And that the fact that the intermediate level, the lower level pile supported structure landing would be underwater during a 100-year event within the project life also indicates some need to manage access, although it might be obvious that they shouldn't go, but you never know. So those are the reason why I'm asking the question. So I don't know if you can address that now or later, or we can just discuss it among the board.
So I can just explain the kind of rationale between that intermediate pier. It basically is for access. So we wanted to kind of create a series, you know, because this route is quite a distance out in the water, we had to have more than one gangway. So we wanted to, and needed to actually create an intermediate point at which there could be, you know, kind of a initial pier, and then there's a slope down to the intermediate pier. And then that intermediate pier is really what starts that second gangway, which allows for the flexibility of the floating dock to go up and down. So we really need that intermediate pier in order to essentially not have a very long gangway that has, you know, a very extreme slope when the dock is grounded and, you know, could have other kind of slope issues. So it kind of allows that piece to happen. And actually we have, I think I have it in here. Yeah, we had this strategy where, you know, in the future, you know, as sea levels rise and maybe that intermediate pier isn't needed. Sorry, the orientation changed a little bit here, but when this intermediate pier isn't needed in the future, the idea is that the floating dock and that gangway that fluctuates can just be reattached to the more fixed pier up further upland. Okay.
Yeah, no, that makes sense to me. That all makes sense. With the access, I just wanted to clarify it, and perhaps the board or the staff might be interested in that detail about how within the project life at 100-year water level, that would not be accessible without getting your feet wet. And then also there may be waves of over 2 feet, maybe 2.7, I think, at a 50-year event, which would probably cause the floats to move, which may add questions to whether what kind of public access. So that's really where I'm okay with the ramps and everything. That makes total sense to me, and I thank you for clarifying that. But My other question's still not answered.
Yeah, I think if you could show a design drawing of the float to see how many corners it's attached to the pilings, if it's just on one side or both sides, then and sort of what the clearance is where the pilings go through the float, I think that could probably reassure Bob that it's not going to tilt. So, I would guess that you have piles at each corner probably.
We don't. Oh, they're okay. All on one edge, right? Okay. And the idea is that you're trying to provide a lot of places where kayaks can berth, I guess is the word, even if it's a kayak. Right. More importantly on the end than, but we are not currently showing them on both sides. I guess on the approach section, there's not really any reason why we couldn't swap, you know, back and forth, and it would provide a more stable platform.
Okay. I think that answers my question, and we'll have some discussion on this topic later. Okay. Thank you.
I have a couple of questions because I'm so
kind these of quick clarification questions still, or are these longer discussion kind of questions?
I don't think they are mutually exclusive. If it's longer,
if it needs to be now because we'll lose our place, that's fine. If we're just, I think I'd like to try and finish the presentation okay. If you can.
All right.
And then we'll come back.
That's fine.
I think the rest of it can be pretty quick. Do you want to go for it?
All right. So this slide just shows the elevations of the different items, design items on here. The intermediate landing, as Bob brought up, is at plus 10. And then the finished floor elevation of the boathouse is at 16, which is over, I think it was 15, the flood elevation. And then on the marineway wall, we're at basically mean high water there at the plus 6 at the bottom of the marineway wall. I think we can go to the next slide. I think the sequence of the last three or four slides here are just projected sea level rise and where that puts the water within a plan view. There's not really, right, so it creeps up, I guess, is the, I don't really have any more discussion on that than.
Yeah, I can speak to this. So, okay. So yeah, I mean, I'm just, you know, there are a series of slides and the purpose of them is to really show in the three levels of blue how those three different tidal datums are kind of tracing the topography on the site. So the mean high water, the king tide, and the base flood elevation at each of the sea level rise projections. So kind of skip to 2050 just so you could see that. And then I'll move through. Now it's stuck. Okay. So then 2070, again, the main takeaway here is that our design elements that are structures and the bay trail and even this Bay City Ferry deck, which is basically a gathering deck, are all well above the BFE at 2070. We do see inundation into the gravel shore and upland into this area that's a grass transition zone. But this is designed to have that flexibility with these higher tides to be able to have that inundation come in and then recede. And then at this time, you know, Wreck and Park could also determine to add more gravel shore if that was desirable from a programming standpoint. They could just add more gravel at this point and to kind of replace the grass area. And then in 2100, again, you can see those three tidal datums. So the lightest color is the one at BFE. The second darkest is the king tide at 14.7. Again, you can see it's coming into these areas at that point over the fixed pier, the upper fixed pier, but it's still below the top finished floor of the boathouse. And then the bay trail is set above that 14.7 as well. So really in 2100, the BFE will flood over the bay trail, but just in one portion. and the Bay Trail is exposed area concrete. So this should be a fairly, you know, when this event happens, there's just going to need to kind of be some potential minor repair of that area. And then this is just, again, a summary of those elements. So the key elements, the boathouse, the base city ferry deck, and the trails, and the Bay Trail dashed in magenta here, looking at 2050 on how they're all above those levels. And then just looking back at our site, just seeing that main lawn unfold down the center with that gravel shore at the very end, and then the marine way wall on the left side, and then the floating dock coming forward towards us on the right side. This is a rendering. Yes, sorry.
It's a picture.
Thank you. That's it.
So board members, if you're getting ready to present something, actually right now we're not doing board member stuff, right? We have public comment, I believe, right? So thanks, project team. Now public comments. At this point, I'd like to receive public comments, if any, on the project, specific to the presentation. Please raise your hand, digital hand, if you're online, or nobody's in the one person in the audience. If you're in the audience and want to talk, raise your hand physically. Please state your name and affiliation at the beginning of remarks. Remember, you have a 3-minute time limit. As in any meeting, please keep your comments respectful. We're here to listen to everyone who wishes to address the meeting. But as always, we ask everyone to act in a civil manner. Hate speech, threats made public, directly or indirectly, and abusive language will not be tolerated. And anyone who fails to follow these guidelines or who exceeds the established 3-minute limit without permission will be muted. Grace, will you let us know if there's anyone who has their hands raised and call their names and state when no more hands are raised?
There are no hands raised for public comment.
Oh, there is one hand raised behind you, a physical hand. Wow, a physical hand. That's an exciting thing.
You can come up here and speak.
Hello, everyone. My name is Jade Carter. I'm an undergrad student at University of San Francisco, and I've been involved with the Equitable Development Plan portion of this project through Rec Parks. I just have a question for you all about kind of how you're drilling into the bay for this construction. I'm aware that one of the remediation techniques in the cleanup process at 900 Innes and Ada Basin was to place sand and soil caps offshore to prevent the re-exposure of soil contaminants. And I'm curious how this offshore construction aims to prevent the re-exposure or uncovering of these contaminants back into the bay. Thank you.
You can stay there for a minute if you want while they respond.
I can provide a quick answer. The remediated area was at 900 Innes, not at India Basin Shoreline Park. So we're actually not penetrating any caps at this portion of the project.
Do you want to bring up a map and kind of show generally where those remediations there are compared to the project site?
So the 900 Innes site is, if you can see the mouse kind of moving around, that's the site right there. And then the basin, which is looks like a lighter brown area, was the area that was remediated. And we didn't remediate all the way out to where that color changes in the water tide, but maybe about midway through is where we removed about 2 to 5 feet of sediment, both upland and in the water. Off-hauled it and then imported new sediment or new fill to cap that area.
Does that address your question?
Okay, yeah.
And Grace, are there any other hands raised online?
There is one. Hello, caller. For the record, please state your name and affiliation. You have 3 minutes.
Hi, my name is Catherine Langstiff, and I'm with the Wild Oyster Project. And I've been interested in using living shorelines here at the site to help buffer wave action, but also to increase biodiversity. And I've had the pleasure of talking with some of the design team, but I wanted BCDC to understand that there's an opportunity here that I think would be a really great one.
Can you share a little bit more about your ideas?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sorry, do you have an echo? Is that better? So if you go to the slides with the inundation, you can see, and also with a discussion around the fascia panel, there's an opportunity there where you were talking about, I think you called it scouring, that we could use oyster reefs as a way to buffer the wall, but also to help sort of seed the wall with native oysters. And we've had success with the Port of San Francisco right across India Basin at Heron's Head Park. And I think it's a great opportunity for us to continue using nature-based solutions in this area. Another idea would be to line the shoreline, as you see when you get to the 2100. By that point, you have a lot of flooding, which would allow oyster habitat to have to move inland, which becomes water, right? Over this 60-year period or longer, you can see how the oyster habitat could keep buffering the shoreline as it moves inward.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Do we respond to the public comment?
Would the team like to respond to the public comment? We'll have our chance later.
Sure, we can. So we recently met with Catherine from the Wild Oyster Project to look at our site and try to see if there were any opportunities or possible opportunities for oyster reef balls. It looks like due to elevations that it may be difficult at our site within our project limits to achieve, but we're still looking into it. And I don't remember the numbers off the top of my head, but I think they have to be submerged for a certain amount of time. Do you remember?
Yeah. So trying to find a good image. So basically our extent of kind of grading work into the shoreline ends at about elevation 1. And from my understanding, the oysters do best when they're set at about an elevation of 0 at their kind of base, because of the tide fluctuations that we have here, that allows them, it would still be visible because we go out to a -1 or -2 tide sometimes, but it gives them enough water most of the time that they're mostly covered at that 0. So there are certain areas where we might explore having them. If you can see my mouse, kind of this area upper left corner is a potential site where the existing topography brings us pretty close to the 0 contour. But in these other areas further upshore, or I don't know what the right term is, but basically we're up at elevations 1, 2, or 3, even though it is showing inundated, right? Because our mean high water is at around 5, right? But at those higher elevations, it's just a mudflat. And so it may just not be the best place for the oysters, but we are exploring them on or along the marine way wall.
So I think that Catherine is asking specifically about, although elevations change effectively due to sea level rise. So in 30 years, elevation 0 is what, I mean, it will look like 0 where it's right now, elevation 3 or whatever. And that if you do it now, the oysters can kind of walk their way up the slope as sea level rise occurs. Is that How does that fit with what you just said, what you just described?
I mean, well, again, we're, you know, we recently met with her and we're looking at opportunities to try to incorporate them if possible.
Okay. Grace, any more hands?
I do have one more. It might be the same caller, but I'm not sure. Hello, for the record, please state your name and affiliation. You have 3 minutes.
Yes, thank you so much. This is Catherine Langstaff. I appreciate the team and meeting with me. And I just wanted to say that we're exploring not reef balls, but oyster reefs that are created through bag shell. And I think that that's something that might change the elevation in our favor. So thank you for listening. I appreciate it.
So Catherine, Liz, or you guys have other respond to what you just said? Is that still part of your discussion? Same as what you're doing? Yeah.
I would say that we're still, you know, trying to evaluate if it's a possibility at our project site.
Yeah. You know, I just want to comment on this if I can. I was thinking the same thing. I mean, most of the oyster work in the Bay is with these cast structures, whether reef balls or castles or whatever. But, you know, in other parts of the world, and maybe historically in the Bay, there were reefs or you know, just benthic type coverings of oysters, and maybe the rocks that are part of the design could be a substrate. I don't know. I'm not a biologist, but, you know, what she said sounded like it might be a little more feasible than if you're placing a reef ball, which is, you know, has some height to it. The one thing I would say is you probably don't want the oysters where people are going to walk, like at the bottom of the gravel beach. I mean, assuming somebody might walk out there. I mean, it's not too bad if you know they're there, but you really don't want to step on oysters, I don't think.
Yeah, it's going to be a balance between public use and kayaks are entering and it could be potentially entering from the floating dock and the gravel beach. So we don't want them to impede on potential future oyster habitat.
Yeah.
We are also looking at possibly incorporating oyster shells into the marine way walls to kind of try to increase the habitat on the wall.
Okay, thanks. Grace, any more now? Okay, no more hands in the audience here and no more hands online. So then we will move on to board discussion. To start, please raise your hand, turn on your mic to make sure your camera is on while you're speaking. And Bob stuck his hand up first and Ramin is right behind him.
Okay, so.
Yeah, I just would like, I have an echo, or do I? I thought I had an echo. Now I don't. All right.
No, you do.
I do.
Somebody does.
Okay. How was that? Somebody else has their microphone, or somebody has their.
Your computer is unmuted. Bob, yours is not.
I'm not using my computer audio, so it's not me. So now it sounds okay. Thank you. I think just to cut to the chase, probably I will suggest that or recommend that supervision and adaptive management of operational restrictions to occur due to wave action that induces float motions and the high water levels that inundate the lower pier deck and floats. So that's kind of not worded that well, but basically I guess we could ask for some sort of analysis of the float motions during certain wave conditions and have a better understanding of what level of wave action, 10 year, 20 year, 50 year type wave action would induce float motions that aren't really appropriate for public access. If that's the case, in which case perhaps the public shouldn't have free access to the floats and or if it's flooded and then so what would you do about it? And that would be some sort of management of the operational conditions. But I think in lieu of asking for a whole study and stuff and realizing that the design's not complete yet, an alternative would be to expect that would be addressed in the design and or in the operational management or the management of operational conditions, which would be some sort of closure or other approach, which could be adaptively managed, which might be more practical. I don't know. So I just throw that out there. But I think I do have a concern about having a float that far out where the waves could be get to the point where somebody might fall off or, you know, something like that. Thank you.
Would the team like to respond to that?
Well, I can note that we will have a just a kind of chain at the very top here next to the boathouse before you start the entering the first kind of fixed pier, which can be managed. I don't know when.
Go ahead. Yeah, we can. We've discussed with our operations and maintenance we will need to adaptive or do some sort of adaptive management depending on how this is how you know what happens after it's built, but we are currently having a chain put in so that we could close it off. We went back and forth with having a chain or a gate, and you know if someone wants to jump over, they're going to jump over no matter what it is. So we thought that we would put a chain in for now and sign it if needed, depending on the situation.
So Bob, is that sufficient or do you need something more than that?
No, I think it's, I mean, the risk is on the city and others. And, you know, so I feel like they're aware of it and motivated to deal with it. So I don't have any.
So I think we're on record now as having recommended, and they're on record as having being aware of the concerns and having a response.
Yeah, thank you.
So I think maybe that's
accurate. I'm good. Thank you.
Ramin.
Thank you all for your presentation. I heard some words that I need a clarification in my mind. I heard performance base. And then I heard pushover analysis, any time history type, any response history analysis. So it's basically a spectral type analysis. So I don't know if that qualifies as performance-based type approach or not. But so that's one thing. And the other thing is, in my mind, I'm very surprised considering the soft conditions out there that such high PGAs were used for liquefaction evaluation. I mean, your ground response analysis computes almost half of that. So I'm kind of a little unclear on that. You can use a code value, I guess it's really high, but since you have done all the site-specific evaluations, I think it begs the question, what is the impact and does it need this level of perhaps ground modification that you're considering?
So in other words, they may be over-conservative.
They may be over-conservative.
By not taking credit for attenuation of the ground motions in the liquefiable.
Not only that, also considering that this interbedded sand and clay, the lower below the fill, doesn't seem to me, based on the results from your boring logs, that is as potentially liquefiable as you have considered it, especially with very low, it seems to me, residual strength that you're assigning. So I think you should take a look at that and see if that's really justified. And what is the basis, really, more than anything?
Sure, thanks. So I think actually the
we have some layers of the liquefiber layer. It's very thin in that interbedded sand below the Young Bay Mod. The blow counts, I think it was in high teens, even though in most cases was on the top 20s or 30s, that portion was not liquefiable. But for those areas which was high teens, it turns out to be liquefiber by procedure that we followed there.
Sure. Then the next follow-up question would be like, for example, in your idealized geologic section DD, plate 5D in your report, I think it's part of the presentation. Yeah, right there. Yeah, that's the one. So that layer is about 20 feet or so thick. And at least based on the table you provided, you're assigning a residual strength of 400 PSF to that layer. Is that what was used in your evaluations?
Let me see what was the, I have the boring logs for the B3, right?
Right.
So you can see that we have some blow counts in the order of like 20, and it's all been potentially liquefied. The upper portion of it is very dense. I mean, it's not even dense, it's medium dense because that's the mod cal. So we have to multiply it by 0.6 to get the SPT values. So that's about high 20s. But as it goes down, it is turning all everything to potentially liquefiable.
And I think it gets clayier too. So I think it begs the question whether or not it's the liquefaction issue, especially in that deeper layer, is as severe. But if...
So there's some sense in which us as representing public agency that's looking out for the health and safety of the public, they've got health and safety maybe beyond what is, they got some conservatism that's not perhaps even needed. But we're not objecting to being unsafe.
I'm not objecting to being unsafe. I'm just saying, what is the basis? This is an engineering review board. So you're reviewing engineering criteria.
So we are just following the procedures by Bollinger and Idris for triggering the liquefaction. And for that particular layer, it seems to be triggered. It may not be everywhere. But when we are designing for the piles, we are kind of designing it based on that particular one there.
So one way to look at it perhaps is blow count sampling doesn't account for thin layer correction very well. You can get one low blow count and it looks like it's 5 feet thick on your the way you one applies it. Whereas if you look at that back as a CPT, you might see that it'll look okay. There are some sequential thin zones that are 12 inches thick, but they're interlayered, interfingered, and so on. And so some of that can go away frequently with others. Sealic, you can get rid of that often, get rid of much of that. I think. Who's it has there's some other newer methods as well.
Yeah, actually, if you look at the boring B9 also, you will see that we have some layers with the teens, I mean, not even low teens, a blow count in there. So
I looked at B9 too, by the way.
So it's
actually the blow counts are even better in B9. Now, one thing I would like you to comment on, because it does say this has gravels in it. If you are, from your judgment, considering that your blow counts in a small sampler is
is elevated artificially because of presence of gravel, that's one thing. But I didn't see any statement to that effect in the report that qualifies or the particular blow counts in that sense. And again, I go back to also liquefaction evaluation based on PGA values, which I don't think are reasonable for the conditions you have. And your own analysis is showing it too.
Right. So if you look at the blow counts in B9, at 30 feet, we have 21. At 35, we have 10. At 40, we have 15. Those are very low blow count for that depth.
But wait. I don't want to get into this.
Those are pretty clean sands.
Yeah.
That's about 15 feet of
layer. They are, I mean, it says clay lens in oh, shoot. God dang it. So based on your own boring log, it has a lot of perhaps finer material in the clays and silts that reduces the blow counts and potentially is not as severe in terms of liquefaction behavior and all of that. I'm just suggesting that it seems to me to be overly conservative assigning these very low values to this fairly thick layer.
Very good.
I ran out of battery, so I had to plug in.
You have a cord.
So when they go with, they're setting a performance criteria for the ground treatment for the DSM, will, is this conservative assumption mean that they will overtreat the soil?
It's probably not related to whether it needs to be treated or not, because the treatment is, I think, primarily for bay mud, which is not a liquefaction issue. It's a softness, weakness, compressibility issue. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we are not doing soil improvement for liquefaction purposes.
Okay.
Yeah. So I think the suggestion from Ramin is that you take this under consideration and go back and take a look.
Sure.
And that seems like a reasonable thing to me, is to take it back and take it under consideration and relook at it. In our role of protecting the public, I think that if you leave it where it is, with respect to this comment, at least you're on the conservative, safe, public is protected side of things, and so we wouldn't object necessarily. It's maybe more conservative than necessary. Maybe it's going to cost a little more money than necessary. Maybe it doesn't make that much difference after all. But I think if you consider it again.
City and County of San Francisco is a public entity as well. So that's public funds as well. So
I'm not representing them.
No, I'm not.
let's see. Let's see, Bob, I think your hand is still residually left up.
I'll lower my hand. That was a mistake. Thank you.
And I think Gail is up next.
Okay, thanks. Could you go to, I think it's slide 25 that has the elevation of the pier with all the structures?
The elevation?
The one? Yeah, that one right there. A few questions for you on this. The gangways that connect the piers, What's the intent for how those are attached to the pier structures? Will they be attached on one side with a slider roller on the other end?
I can't turn my camera on because it's dead. But so they're basically pinned on the top. And then for the first two gangways, so the first segment, they are on like UHMW pads because we're not expecting much movement.
Okay.
And then the next ones are on rollers.
Okay, so each one of them is attached one,
yep.
rolling the other.
Yep.
Okay, so in the basis of design, when they talk about the design of the pier and intermediate landings, there's a mention of one of the steps is to develop actual deck displacements mm-hmm. at the four corners of the deck, corresponding to displacement demand to verify that the seismic gap is adequate. Mm-hmm. And I didn't understand what was being checked when they said seismic gap, because I think what needs to be checked is to make sure that if you get differential movement where the two piers are or two structures are going different directions, you want to make sure you just have a large enough seat that you're not dropping your gangway into the water. So that's
agreed. Yes. And there's actually, well, there's the gangways, but then there's also the land side, right? There's a gap. There's a small gap. Well, there's a, it's like 12 inches there, gap right there where the arrow is, that's allowed to move. Well, between the pier and the slab.
So that's to avoid pounding is what yes. you're talking about.
Yeah.
And then there's also a plate. Then I assume that's over. Mm-hmm. Okay. So I just think for all of these interfaces, I think you need to consider moving apart from each other and just make sure that yep. you're not going to lose vertical
end up
support.
In the drink.
Okay, so I think that just needs to be added as a specific criteria because it wasn't clear. On a related issue, you mentioned about these things actually being underwater at some point further down. Is that right? The last mm-hmm. gangway,
yep.
maybe underwater. So I think then, is anyone looked at, do these actually become buoyant and potentially uplift and come off?
I have not looked at that. But
I think you just need to look at an uplift condition okay. from buoyancy, and you can just probably detail it with stops of some kind or passive restraints. But anything that's going underwater that's not designed for it, you got to look at the buoyancy and uplift.
Okay.
And then the last comment I had was that, Jen, one of the questions had to do with instrumentation. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a requirement for seismic instrumentation on a new project. And you guys are aware of that, I assume?
I know that they did that at Treasure Island.
Yeah. And okay. you need to interface with CGS on that.
Okay.
And they've had a lot of personnel changes there. So I think Jen can make sure you have the right person to talk to. I don't know that there's any special features on this that require any fancy monitoring of multiple instruments. I would think just some free field accelerometers would be good enough. Anybody else have any opinions on that? Jim or Bill? Anything special that you see? I don't think the pier needs anything. I think if there's anything with the DSM that needs any special. No, okay. So just we'll trust staff to take care of making sure that that's done then. Just that they need to interface with CGS for the monitoring seismic instrumentation. And it should be fairly minimal here. No special things that we think are, you know, need to be addressed. There's nothing unique about this site.
Well, I mean, that's one of the things that, Jen, you had reiterated in your staff summary. I think there's some questions about one of the criteria of the BCDC is to provide seismic instrumentation for any significant projects. I think that's what you were referring
to,
right?
Exactly.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm sure if Roger were here, he would say you got to put in lots of instrumentation. This is
I'm a little bit on the fence on this project. It's a relatively modest project. Life safety is life safety. That matters. But as far as any structures, there's nothing very big, it seems to me. And
CGS may say we have pre-field instruments nearby and there's really no value in it. I mean, I think that's a discussion with them.
Yeah, so I'm not quite sure how we should attack this. Bill, do you have
I think these instruments are part of a system. So if there are nearby, then that would say you may not need one. But if there isn't one nearby, then that site may, you know, fill in the system somehow. So there should be some interaction with the state.
The last time I checked in with CGS and the engineer there in charge of their seismic monitoring program, they said they wanted to hear recommendations from the board on where the devices should go and that they weren't going to be making decisions on where it should go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it would be beneficial to at least put one on the structures to see the peer behavior and also where you have the fill and the bay mud that, you know, more data is always better. So that would be my recommendation. A big pun?
Would you say towards the end of the DSM, I would assume? Right, because it's pretty long.
My interest would be on the soft ground, not on the improved ground.
Okay.
Because that's an area that data is lacking.
See, I can see three points of interest. One would be out on the pier. One would be on top of the MSE to see how the ground improvement strengthens and stiffens things, changes periods and amplifications and so on. And one would be on the soft ground, so you know what the MSE/DSM has changed it from. Maybe what we do is we send this off to Hamid or whoever's handling this now with the CGS and let Jen and the team interact with CGS about what would be appropriate.
Happy to do that.
Perfect.
Skylar wants to turn your microphone.
Gail is still on the floor.
I can read it. It's not the latest yet. Okay, do you want to?
Sorry, we interrupted our discussion because there's someone from the public who also wants to make a statement named Art. And if you can hear me,
I did already.
We have promoted you to speaker, and so you can go ahead and unmute yourself and talk.
He's on. He's a panelist now.
Yeah, I'm my comments are done. Thanks, Jim.
Okay. Art, are you able to get your microphone working? We see that you've joined the meeting. Why don't we, Art, can you go ahead and speak? It looks like you might be unmuted.
I'll just read the comment from Art. He says, I was watching the presentation and was interrupted on my end. I may have missed it, but wanted to mention that it appears that the BFE calculations and corresponding elevation benchmarks do not include freeboard, a factor of safety, which typically ranges from 2 feet to 4 feet and will likely be required for final FEMA certification.
Is FEMA certification a part of this project?
No, but we will confirm that. We don't think so.
So this is not a flood protection / FEMA regulated project?
No.
There may be requirements in the coastal floodplain management for the project, which perhaps is what the commenter is commenting on. So that would be, I guess, City, County, San Francisco floodplain manager judgment on the criteria. And I don't have it. I can't think exactly what it, usually it's a foot above the total water level, but there, perhaps there's another one for piers. I'm not aware of that.
We can look into it and get back to you.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks. Jima's hand doesn't show up on Zoom, but he had his hand up.
Okay. Thank you. So, Cameron, I have a few questions for you. You described the materials as heterogeneous. So there's a lot of variability, especially in the fill. Right? But I see that you just have a single value for the strength of these materials, which are really variable. How did you decide on just a single value for potentially variable properties for these layers?
Yes. So essentially the values that you are looking at is mostly for the piers. So it's the closest boring, using the closest boring. And then we use the closest boring for the, you know, that we encounter fill in there. Offshore boring, of course, we didn't have fill, but for the onshore, we use a conservative value for that fill material that we had it there.
Okay. But yeah, my camera is not.
He's having trouble here.
Unfortunately, I'm not appearing. But you have the fill for the slope stability analysis that you did also, right? Where you interface with the MSC wall. You did some slope stability.
That's an engineered fill that we are going to place it.
Oh, it's engineered fill.
Yes.
Oh, okay. All right. So what kind of material are you looking to specify for that engineered fill?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear.
What material are you looking to specify for the engineered fill?
Well, I mean, typically we are just going to, I think they're going to put maybe more granular material there and compact it to minimum 90%. That's okay. What they are planning to do, I think.
Okay. So when you talk about the contiguousness of the liquefiable soils, were you talking, is that the, which layer is that referring to?
This is the existing fill.
The existing fill. Okay. And I think you've concluded that they are not contiguous.
Correct. The liquefiable layers are not necessarily continuous. They are localized mostly.
Okay.
And also we have a revetment next to the road that also prevent the movement there also.
Okay. All right. You are thinking of using lime treatment to for your DSM. Is this dry or wet?
No, it's a wet.
Okay. All right.
Wet quick lime or hydrated lime?
Hydrated lime, I think.
Okay. All right. And I think you mentioned that you wanted tangential.
Yes, because this is essentially providing a bearing for the material on the top. Then we wanted to have tangential with a geogrid on top of it there.
Okay. I mean, why not secant? Because, you know, I mean, you have this stiff material that you want to act together. You want them to act together, right? Are you opposed to using a secant?
I'm not opposed to use the secant method on that.
Okay. Yeah, because the way I see it is that the whole system, your MSC wall, then this DSM, is kind of like a stress magnet, you know, within the matrix of, you know, you have fill, you have loose material, soft material. And so it will tend to attract forces to it. Right?
Understand.
So as best as you can, you want it to
interlock them.
Yeah.
Understood.
So I'm curious, Jimu, if it was if they're doing DSM cells or DSM wall, then secant overlapping is critical. Because, but they're filling in the entire mass, I think, right? Or it's there's all the circles are bumped into all the circles, right? And so there's not really wide open spaces. So is secant quite as important when they have a mass fill rather than just a, you know, filling in, you know, creating DSM cells?
Well, I mean, the what is going to happen is that, you know, these are going to be installed at different times, right? So by the time you do the next one, you know, one is already cured. And so I think getting everything to act together because it's acting as a stress magnet is beneficial to the overall response of the system. Okay, let's see what else I have here. I mean, I know Jen mentioned, you know, whether there's a need for data or gathering or not. But the way the thing that I see might be useful is actually to monitor displacement, especially, you know, near the interface of the fill and the what I call the system, the MSC wall, and then the DSM wall. So something like an inclinometer, you know, at that location would kind of give you an idea of what is happening, you know, between the stress magnet and the material, you know, offshore to the onshore side of the system.
Doing about for earthquake displacements or for during construction displacements?
Well, earthquake displacement, yeah. Especially.
So So you want an inclinometer between the MSC and the infill in the walkway.
Yeah. Yeah. So because you will see what is happening, any kind of displacement is going to be happening more on the onshore side of the of that system. That's it for me.
Nick.
Okay, thank you. If you would be kind enough, put slide 20 on there. And really my comment it follows the discussion on the how to instrument this. I would submit that if you look at this, you have a outline of a Bay City Ferry remains. You have a bunch of different structures here. I do not see a place that one could place a seismic instrument that one could then actually interpret the results with any kind of useful way. However, as Jima mentioned, an inclinometer or possibly a fiber optic in there, because that gives you continuous response and can even manage seismic, would be a really good implementation, and Caltrans is working on it, and I know CGS is working on it. Some displacement measurement would be better. And these days, LIDAR is cheap. LIDAR before and afterwards will give you the ground displacement very nicely as well. So there are alternatives. I just, from the, we started with question on instrumentation, and we promptly went up to possibly three instruments. And I am racking my head, where would I put a useful instrument in here that one could actually interpret the results based on the complexity of the different structures and the ground conditions. So my recommendation would be to be cautious on putting a lot of effort into instrumentation. But displacement measurements would be incredibly valuable. We lack those in general along the bay margins. That's my comment. Otherwise, I think. Thank
you. Any thoughts?
I think we will look into putting displacement measuring devices, right? I think that makes sense. Where?
Well, it's too much.
Or if it's something that happens, that the monitoring could happen manually in different locations and doesn't necessarily need to happen continuously with instrumentation. That's something that we've also.
Jima's inclinometers are manual, and Nick's fiber optic can be remotely monitored.
Yeah.
So there's.
Well, there are digital inclinometers too. I mean, where you have sensors tilt sensors, and you can actually monitor them remotely. Use that solar kind of system, and you can read it anytime.
So no power required, just a solar panel?
Yes, solar power.
Okay. So I don't know.
Humans are notorious young
and busy after earthquakes.
Mm-hmm.
Justin.
Thanks, Jim. Thank you all for your work on this project. I look forward to visiting the park when it's completed. My questions will be coastal related. Just first, one quick follow-up on Bob's comment about the floating deck. I mean, in addition to the motions of that deck, you mentioned it's a low freeboard deck, so there's also a potential for waves splashing up on it, which could also be a safety hazard. And then on the comment about freeboard and FEMA accreditation, I think as Jim noted, the FEMA accreditation is not applicable probably because this is not a flood protection structure. Not to say that consideration of freeboard is not a bad idea. And I think the place to look would be the city's floodplain management ordinance, although that probably relates more to buildings than these kind of public access features. But kind of on that topic of freeboard, a lot of the design flood elevations primarily represent like a still water elevation without the effect of wave runup. Mm-hmm. And so I just wanted to note that some of the discussion of like the timing of inundation and impacts due to sea level rise, you know, that, you know, if there are wave events, those could impact those elevations sooner than is kind of laid out here. And so for some of those lower elevation areas, you could have events that would splash up. And so the, you know, those surfaces should be able to accommodate that kind of overtopping and scour of any pathways and things like that. And then on the marine way wall, I guess I'm just, this is still kind of struck me as like, what's the primary purpose of that? Is it to contain that gravel beach fill? Cause it, you know, it's a big substantial structure. And I was like, wait, is the only purpose of this to sort of prop this beach up? Is that the primary function?
So it's not just the gravel shore. Sorry, I'm looking for a plan. Mm-hmm. So essentially our, you know, there's a design intent here that we didn't go through because we wanted to focus on the engineering components. But overall, the Marineway lawn is a major design feature of this park that continues all the way down to the gravel shore and the water. And this was really, this came out of our earlier concept design that we shared with the community, and it really resonated with the community because of the fact that this provided that generous space and view down to the water, and really in its kind of gesture and kind of openness really emphasized that connection down to the water and that welcoming down to the water. So it's that whole kind of design move all the way down with the pathways, which are also actually a reference and a little bit of an abstraction to the boatyard history of 900 Innes with, you know, the marine rails that pulled up, you know, you pull up boats on those like marine rails, right? Mm-hmm. Which are much smaller than this, but that's the idea behind it. And so that's where this came from in terms of its geometry and design. And, but yes, it does hold the gravel shore and that portion of the lawn, allowing it to be that continuous welcome mat down mm-hmm. to the water. It also does serve other purposes though, because if we, you know, if the Bay City Ferry directly kind of to the east of that, there's an artifact in the water that we can't kind of fill over or penetrate through. And so that kind of limited us on that edge of, you know, what could we do kind of outboard of that? We also obviously wanted to minimize fill. So this is basically the solution we determined that would kind of meet all those program and community goals while minimizing fill and kind of, you know, maintaining that, the Bay City Ferry artifact where it was, obviously. Mm-hmm. So hopefully that answers the question.
Yeah, thank you. That makes sense. The reason I was asking is just for BCDC's question about the potential hydrodynamic impacts of the wall. You talked a little bit about wave reflection. I mean, this is also sort of like a jetty sticking out into the water. And with tidal currents, you know, it could cause some interesting dynamics there. So I think, I don't know if there's been any assessment of sort of how that structure could affect the circulation in that area. And you mentioned that this remnant ship, and it sounds like that portion of the shoreline is not armored. So I think it's the combination of the tidal circulation and waves reflecting off the wall. That could be like a vulnerable spot in the shoreline that could be exposed to erosion.
So the drawings as they are now, my understanding is we couldn't do anything on where the ship is, but actually it turns out that we can regrade. So the plan is to fix the armoring that is there. Mm-hmm. So there mm-hmm. will be shoreline protection mm-hmm. where the ship artifact is. Because we did see that as a vulnerable spot as well.
Okay.
And I just want to clarify on the actual existing riprap slope that's currently there will effectively maintain grading and reestablish the rock, but we still are not filling or placing anything over the part that's in the water, because it's kind of a big boat.
Yeah. Okay. And then just one last question. There was mention of the 50-year design wave looking at the loading on the wall. It just looking at the wind and kind of knowing the wave dynamics, it feels like going up to like a 100-year design wave probably would not be that much bigger. It might give you a little bit additional factor of safety. I'm just wondering why a 50-year wave condition was selected as opposed to a 100-year design condition.
Hey, Mads, are you still on the call?
I am, yes.
Ah, can you answer that question? I think you're the best suited for it.
Yes. I think that is correct, yeah, that a 100-year wave exposure would not be significantly higher than the 50-year. They tend to sort of taper off. But I think the 50-year is a consideration of maybe a 100-year in the perspective of that is maybe too conservative given the life of these types of structures. And there's maintenance too. So I think putting in these docks, they probably wouldn't last for, I'm not a dock expert, but they probably wouldn't last for 40 years or or longer without some significant amount of maintenance or replacement along the way. So I think that's the idea behind that.
But in addition to the docks, I think the 50-year wave was used for the wave loading on the wall, which presumably could last longer than 40 years.
Yeah. But Sean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't believe wave loading on the wall would govern its pushing in that material behind it.
No, it would govern. That's one of the main loads that we're using on the wall, Mads, is the wave load, because it's not really retaining any soil. So the wave load is one of the main, I guess, out of that, it probably would make sense to look at a little bit longer design life or design wave height.
Yeah, or at least check it, see what the sensitivity of the design is to the 100-year. Yeah,
that's fair.
Yeah, it may not affect you. Yeah.
Okay,
thank you.
Yeah, I would just comment too that I think for the case with there would be substantial or significant wave loading on the wall would be a high water level condition, right? So, but then for the exposed portion, there would be water behind the wall too. Is that right, Sean? So you would have hydrostatic pressure on the backside of the wall.
That's so true, but there's still the impact load from the wave.
Yeah, but that would then be discontinuous along the wall, right? So where you would have a wave splashing up in other portions of the wall, there would be a wave trough or other change in water levels. So I don't know how we applied the loads, but if we applied the 50-year wave load as a continuous line load along the wall, that would likely be pretty conservative.
That is what we did. Oh, we can look at sensitivity at least to see how much it affects.
So my hand is up, so I'll call on myself. I have a few comments. Basically, a nice looking presentation and overall well done, I think. I have a few comments. Slide 10, maybe if you can call slide 10 up. I'll justify this as engineering criteria, as in we ought to follow good geological principles in geomorphology. And if you look in the middle of those explorations, the CPT, I guess, it shows that actually the left one to B3 shows bay mud being at elevation 3 or 4, it looks like, which is probably not correct in this case. My guess is there's some soft, undocumented existing fill. It won't make any difference in analysis other than it sort of looks funny to me.
If you go to the next slide, slide 11, there's bay mud that's above elevation zero also, but I think that one I can defend as being there's probably a mud wave, it looks like, because bay mud is lower on the left. And when fill was placed, it may have pushed the bay mud up in that spot where it's too high. So that seems reasonable. I wouldn't change that. But anyway, nitpicky stuff just to prove that we read the materials. More substantive, perhaps, QC testing on the DSM. I think I read someplace there's a pilot program planned. Okay, so that's all good. I think I didn't see anything, at least, about a QC program for the DSM. It seems like 20 PSI is probably pretty achievable, but it's, if it's what your assumptions are, you need to document somehow that not just in the pilot program, but that you have some sort of a QC. I think it needs to be emphasized somewhere in the reports that QC on the DSM is important. Along the same lines, I guess, in the drawings, it looks like DSM kind of is sitting on top of, what's the bottom? That's rock, I think, right? And it seems like there should be some discussions, at least. You probably want to tow a foot into it or 2 feet into it. I'm not sure how you know that you're on top of bedrock unless you push hard enough to grind into it a little bit. And so probably some discussion about how you know that you're in bedrock when how you know you've reached the maximum depth required for the DSM. Just document that it's required that you you feel the rock and add a foot or two or something like that. It doesn't need to be a lot, I think. But settlement, I think, Cameron, you said that you might get a couple of feet of settlement under the MSE, which is why you're putting the DSM in. But the fill behind the MSE is almost as high. So presumably the settlement of the fill behind the MSE would still be something like 2 or 3 feet. And I didn't see that discussed anyplace. And that's going to affect, may affect drainage, may affect, the grading. It more than a few inches, you're going to start to affect the way sidewalks cross it or way drainage happens, the way things pond behind the MSE wall if it rains heavily, something. Curious how that has been addressed, since that was one of the five critical geotechnical issues, and I didn't really see that addressed.
Yes, thank you. So definitely we will do the pilot program for DSM. During a pilot program, we will develop some sort of the QC also that to go with it there. The at least 2 feet into the bedrock, we were thinking that maybe a 1 foot, but then we, during the pilot program, we will develop some sort of the pressure that they have to place it there or the dragging and everything's there. We do, of course, getting some cores during for that and test it, and during the coring we can figure out that if they are penetrating into the bedrock or not there.
So all that sounds good. I'm just saying that should be documented. I didn't see it. Maybe I didn't read everything word for word through all of your large presentation. Yeah, but
they will all gonna be into the project specifications there for the DSM there.
Yeah. So anyway, so I think what your plan is sounds good, but just documented in the geotech report or in the drawings or someplace.
Correct. Jim, could I follow up on something you said? Were you saying that you're concerned about the settlement where the gravel is being placed between the in the kind of marine rail way, the gravel beach or the
whatever is behind the MSE, which is not just gravel, is it?
There's some engineered fill.
Yes, there's going to be some engineering fill behind it.
Yeah, I was wondering a little bit about that too, in terms of placing the engineered fill down in the lower parts where it's kind of low or intertidal. And I guess there'd have to be some sort of cofferdamming or something. But there was a project just recently across the way at Heron's Head where gravel was placed on mud and fill. And on the mud, there were places where it sank immediately, and there were little mud waves and mud boils and interesting things. So that is something to be aware of.
So if you are placing a lot of fill, is it going, it must be going like directly over Bay Mud in some places at least, right? And so
correct.
the whole mud wave criteria should be addressed and talked about pretty carefully, and you know, research that, because there's lots of old experience about placing thick fills on top of Bay Mud and developing mud waves where, you know, you can get multiple feet of settlement at the beginning of the fill, and then multiple feet of heave in front of where the fill is being placed, and then you place it in it. Much of the time it may not matter, but it may have impact on stability analysis if the mud wave is happening under the toe of the fill.
And the mud boils are really interesting looking. You know, they just kind of, it kind of bubbles up.
Right.
Yeah. But it, you know, obviously, to some extent, once that happens, you have something that continues to move as you place more fill. I'm not a geotechnical expert.
Strengths, you know, soft and Bay Mud strengths instead of sensitive strengths, which are weak but not softened.
What he said.
Thank you. Yeah, so probably should be some discussion about mud wave prevention. You know, start with some thin levels of layers of fill to try and get it all held down, and maybe you even need to
maybe geotextiles or something.
You
like
can
that.
Potentially put geotextiles, but that may not prevent the mud waves from happening. Or I mean, for the first few lifts, at least the geotextile won't help. It would help after you get the first couple of lifts in. If you put the geotextile under the first couple of lifts, it'll help for the subsequent lifts. But so there should be probably some discussion about how to prevent mud waves from happening.
Sure. Yes, we will.
That's what I had for new stuff. Jen, did you want to talk about combined, the email you sent me just before the meeting? Did you want us to talk about it? The applicant asked me, we are unclear as to which scenarios with both earthquake and flooding should be analyzed and what analysis should be is being requested. Could the ECRB please expand on this? No. Okay, take that back. Strike that from the record. Any other new topics? And we'll talk about what needs to be required if we're going to have any requirements going forward or motions.
Topic, but I wanted to add to what you said about the mud wave. I mean, you can also consider the use of lightweight material, right? Reduce the thickness of the fill.
For lightweight material, we have to just make sure it doesn't boil until coming up. But yeah, like maybe lightweight aggregate or something like that. Yes.
Or what's been used most reliably in the Bay Mud margins fill is municipal waste.
The one thing about the lightweight. That was an engineering joke. One thing I like but about the lightweight aggregate, it's not going to be as stable under waves, so the upper layers probably have to be a denser gravel, or the aggregate is going to have to be sized appropriately for the wave exposure, given if it has a lower density. But I think your coastal folks can sort that out.
I don't see any other comments from the ECRB. Go ahead, Catherine.
Yeah, I just had a clarifying question from our team here related to the monitoring. We just want to understand, is the monitoring a requirement for the project because it may influence our design, or is it a monitoring for another kind of purpose?
Well, the seismic monitoring, which is within the purview of the ECRB, is for the benefit of the future science and ongoing profession. Monitoring of displacement is, you know, it's not an explicitly mandated direction, or not a directive that we have as the ECRB. And it probably won't change your design, because you won't find out about the displacements until after the fact. I'm not sure, we can discuss it amongst the board here if somebody wants to chime in, whether we have the authority to require that sort of a thing, because it won't change the design and it won't protect things right now. There's some good ideas, there's some interest, there's some, you know, potentially if we think there's really going to be some hazard and life safety types of things that are going to be moving, and we want to know about it early in the deformation
Jim,
progress.
If I understood the question, I think you're asking whether, if I understood the question, you were asking whether it's something that's going to meant to influence a structural design, or if it's just something you're required to do for other purposes. Is that really what?
Yeah, I mean, I think you and was it Jim? Sorry.
Jim.
Yeah, understood the question correctly.
Yeah.
It's just basically, yeah.
Yeah, it's
trying to.
It's really not. Every project has to. It's like an opportunity for the state to increase our seismic network. So really, that's why you're being required to do it. It's not to change what you're doing on your project, but it does affect your project, obviously, because you have to accommodate it, and there are issues, especially with power and things like that. So you want to be careful in how you do it. You don't want it to become too huge of a burden that it drives everyone nuts. So,
and Jen, I don't have in front of me the language that gives us the directive to implement ground monitoring, but my recollection is, in the way we've always done it in my however many years it is I've been on the ECRB, it's been to put in accelerometers, site response type of instrumentation. And I don't know that we've ever required inclinometers, physical or fiber. And I'm not sure if where that fits.
Yeah, thank you. I was going to mention we do have a safety of fails policy, number 3. It says to provide vitally needed information on the effects of earthquakes and all kinds of soils. Installation of strong motion seismographs should be required on all future major landfills. In addition, the commission encourages installation of strong motion seismographs and other developments on problem soils and in other areas recommended by the U.S. Geological Survey for purposes of data comparison and evaluation.
You can get displacement in there, I know those words.
Yeah.
Well, still seismic monitoring.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think the way we need to look at it, though, is, you know, there are simplifying assumptions that we are making with respect to something which is really a system. You know, we break it down to make it easy to analyze. And it's prudent to verify that the assumptions, the way you expect this system to behave, is the way it's behaving. Because if there should be failure, the impact is significant, right? So you have an opportunity to react if you see that something is happening. And I think that falls under, you know, kind of, you can interpret that to mean that we don't want failure. We don't want the failure placed in to fail. You don't want to jeopardize lives, you know. And so monitoring what you have put in based on your analysis, I think it's important.
You could just sec for me, and then your next reread the sentence that includes seismographs.
I think both sentences included seismographs, but I guess I'll just read it again. So to provide vitally needed information on the effects of earthquakes on all kinds of soils, installation of strong motion seismographs should be required on all future major landfills. In addition, the commission encourages installation of strong motion seismographs in other developments on problem soils and in other areas recommended by the U.S. Geological Survey for purposes of data comparison and evaluation. And I'll put it in the chat as well. I'll do that.
So let's see. What is your inclination?
Oh, I'm sorry. That was an engineer.
Ramin was going to say something, and then Gail.
That's Nick.
Nick.
Oh, Nick. Sorry.
I mean, I don't have an objection to your proposal, if you will, but I think the directive is really about recording earthquakes rather than ground deformations. That's right. And the other thing about your point about failure, if we're talking about static movements of the ground being an issue, that's a completely different, I mean, we cannot have that. That's, their design should be robust enough that that issue is not even part of the discussion. That issue should be addressed as part of their design.
Yeah, I think I would just add to that maybe by saying if you agree with their design criteria, then I'm not sure additional monitoring, I'm not sure that that can be an additional requirement.
I think there may be cases where it might be. But I'm not sure that's the case right now.
Yeah. Least. Okay.
Nick?
Well, okay. Trying to understand this. First of all, I don't see this as a major fill. It is a fill. It's not a major. Okay. I don't see this as a major structure. This is actually a relatively minor structure. It has impact on the shoreline, as we discussed. You know, there are elements of we want it to perform as designed. Because it is in a challenging environment. You've got wave action, you've got tidal action, you've got currents and all of that, and that affects the shoreline, and we already discussed the shoreline protection. So from the standpoint, you know, the question is, do we insist on instrumentation just because we can put instruments in there, or are we trying to get something useful? In terms of displacements, I was worried about seismic displacement. We have very little data on seismic displacement. We have a lot of acceleration records. Of course, you can get displacements out of acceleration records, no question about it. But then I, as I said, I pointed out, you show me where you want to put those instruments and get information that actually can be interpreted in any useful way. And that's my concern. I know a lot of instrumentation in California, in places that is being used that actually serves no useful purpose when you actually look at the location of the instrument. I can name any number of dams where we have a lot of instruments that only confuse but don't improve. So my concern here is if we're going to put instrumentation there, somebody should look very carefully on where it's located so that the information obtained actually serves the purpose that it's supposed to, which is inform about seismic response. So that would be my comment. And frankly, from my perspective, I am challenged to suggest where we would put it. You can certainly put it on the breakwater and see how the breakwater behaves, but that's a very unique situation. Anyway, that.
And you're saying that about seismographs specifically?
Yeah, I'm commenting on strong motion instruments. You know, the thing is, how to put it, you can publish it in the Journal of Irreproducible Results. And if that's what we get, then that's not helpful. And so all I'm saying is that then very careful attention should be to put the instrument someplace where the results will actually serve to enhance the database in a useful way. So that's all.
So what we talked about earlier was potentially having them talk with USGS and negotiate what to put in. Would you say they don't need to do that even, or encourage them that they would talk to USGS?
No, sure. USGS or CGS, whoever's going to be
monitoring. CGS, I mean.
Yeah, CGS, whoever's going to be monitoring the instrument. Yes, right. Agreed.
Anybody want to speak differently than what Nick just said? It sounds reasonable to me. I think we love data. And this is, the language that they just provided says major projects, and it says, or other projects on problem soils. And I think we might fall under not necessarily major fills, although this is one of the biggest fills I've seen in a dozen years on the board recently. I mean, we don't put any very massive fills in the bay anymore, in part because of BCDC's blockade, I suppose, but and concern for, you know, there's plenty of bay fill that's 100 years old. We've filled in, a third already. So I think it makes sense that we go on record as recommending that they talk with CGS. And we would support whatever the CGS would request on this. Anything new? I think maybe we're done with new topics and we can go on to figure out what do we need to summarize for requests, and or do we want to see the project again? I'll summarize what I've got, I think, so far. I think from Ramin's early comments, we want to advise the team to relook at some of the what accelerations you're putting in to the liquefaction analysis, and relook at some of the blow counts and susceptibility. And you've already talked about discontinuity. Maybe thin layer correction would be a part of that discussion. Maybe presence or absence of gravels would be a question. Maybe the influence of plastic materials on driving blow counts down, which make the blow counts go down, but the plasticity itself makes them not liquefiable. So does that summarize your concerns more or less, with that collection of concerns at least, and a need for us to see it again? There's two options. Three options. We can say, do it and resubmit it in your materials, but we don't need to see it again. We can say, do it and submit it to Jen, and she'll distribute, and one of us will take a look at it and say, yeah, it looks good. Or we can say, no, we as a board want to see the project again.
I mean, in my view, is if the conclusions and recommendations are going to be changed because of these particular evaluations, then for sure it has to, at least document has to come to us for sure.
So that part of it would be then that we would like to have the results resubmitted, whether or not it comes as before a regular board meeting, and that could be potentially evaluated by staff, I guess, in particular, potentially in consultation with the chair or somebody. That was point one. Art suggested that Freeboard be looked at. So I think we're going to recommend that you look at Freeboard. FEMA is probably ruled out, but what do you say, Bob? Coastal Commission may have some input on Freeboard requirements.
I'll let Justin respond to that, but I was thinking that the City County of San Francisco, because of their participation in the National Flood Insurance Program, would be the ones that would identify and articulate any coastal floodplain management requirements for development in the floodplain.
Yeah, it may just be a matter of sort of looking at the design elevations and the projected timing of impacts with sea level rise. with the run-up component and just sort of discussing how your sort of sea level rise lifespan of the project might change with consideration of wave run-up as well.
Yeah, if I could just make a comment on that, clarifying, I used the term total water level before, and total water level in the sense of FEMA is the bay water level plus the wave run up or the wave crest above the water level. Total water level in the BCDC adapting to rising tides is a slightly different definition. So I'm referring, and I think Justin is referring to, although it's your fault that art doesn't include waves, right? Yeah. But that's another engineering joke, sorry. But so we're talking about the wave run up over and above the still water. Even though the waves are supposedly small, your documents indicate a 3.7 or something foot wave in a 50-year wind wave event. So that's not, you know, nothing. Thank you. Sorry, Jim. I couldn't help it.
I was just jotting some notes for myself. That was good. Thanks, Bob. And then we had talked about inclinometers. I think we kind of established that we don't have, that's not within our purview to require, but I think we want to just go ahead and be documented as saying we think that some sort of deformation instrumentation is a cool idea that potentially could be useful. I think it is within our purview to request that you at least talk with CGS about strong motion instrumentation. And we had suggested three potential locations. One would be the pier. One would be on top of MSE/DSM. And one would be somewhere on soft ground.
And Jim, I just wanted to make sure we didn't forget that I think the board recommends that City, County, San Francisco, and perhaps their consultants consider the operational constraints on public access to the floats and along the gangways due to wave-induced float motions and wave and water level-induced flooding.
So they had said that they're going to put a gate up there, which is kind of keeping people out by suggestion. I guess, you know, he said already that people can jump over gates if they want to, or over chains if they want to. And I thought you had said more or less that that was a good enough response.
Well, I'm not sure. I don't want to be on the record supporting or not supporting that response. I would just say that the City, County, San Francisco is responsible for it, as their design consultants are, and in my view, and that I'm okay with not understanding what the operational criteria are and how that's managed, as long as it's clear that they have to take care of it, whether it's a chain or maybe something else.
I think it's the issue is the operational control rather than what the device is.
Yeah. Yeah. That's kind of where I was going. So I think it's an important issue that I think should be on the record. And I know that you heard it, but I just feel like we should write it down.
Specifically different than I had understood it previously. I just didn't catch it. Is that I think our recommendation then is that they go to City and County and work it out.
Well, I think the reason why I say City, County, San Francisco is because Reckon Park is the owner, applicant. Is that correct? So that's why I said that. But I think also their consultants are professionally responsible for that.
Okay. Yeah, without having analyzed those motions, I mean, it could, if you found that it would be frequently unusable, maybe there's a design change that could be made to make it safer. So it might be worth looking at in the design phase, as opposed to just waiting to see how it does and closing it when it's dangerous.
Yeah, I agree. That would be perhaps a more detailed response. And I don't know why I'm being so easy on everyone today, but that would be the typical action, would be to actually address, like if you're designing a ferry berth, there are operational limits on the motions based on the waves. And then the ferry operators shut down the facility, if not the ferries themselves, in that condition. This is a little different. But I would recognize that not only do you have people that might come on from land, you have people that may approach from the water. So maybe some signages or some sort of notice to mariners. Or there may be a number of items that make sense that may evolve, actually, as you figure out how people are going to use this. I think in the design review board meeting, I mentioned having a docent or somebody that's kind of close to a harbor master that might just be aware of what's going on and at least have an emergency response capability. But I think the operational limits are important for the general public on the water. Thanks.
I think if I may, your point that operational limits, if in fact the facility has to be shut down more than 50% of the time because of wave action, then it doesn't serve the purpose that it was intended for. And I think that's the direction from which it should be looked at. What percentage of time would the conditions be so adverse that you would have to limit access to the public to protect their safety? And as I said, if it exceeds 50% of the time, it becomes a red herring as opposed to a useful facility. So I think that's a good point.
Yeah, thank you. That's a better way of stating it. Appreciate that. Thank you.
And then you guys are going to look into the basis of the 40 to 50 year design life.
Yeah, that's actually based on the life of the, or what we expect the life of the floats would be. Right, because they're aluminum and they move around maximum.
It should be, documented somehow. I mean, formally, it's not. Not that I don't trust your judgment, but it shouldn't be your judgment. I mean, the owner should know what do you think the life is.
Well, I think there's two things we're talking about. There's the lifespan of the actual material of the float, which he just mentioned is 40 years. And then there's the anticipated lifespan of the park features. And that's something that we can look into as a department and what Rec Park usually uses as our criteria for design longevity and get back to you.
And you're going to look into 100-year versus 50-year wave. You're going to include a documentation somewhere of the QC program for the DSM, and include documentation about the tow embedment, how that's going to be determined and controlled in the field, and discussion of settlement behind the MSE. Wall of the engineered fill. And it seems to me that what we're looking for is to have it be resubmitted, some of this stuff, the new documentation and
Jim,
discussions.
You missed a couple from me.
Sorry.
I had two other recommendations. One was the seating of the gangways. To verify the seating on the gangways, they need to add that to their design criteria. And the other was to include buoyancy.
Uplift.
To look at the uplift.
Sorry. So
that needs to be put into the criteria.
Okay. Thanks. Anything else I missed? Seems to me that what makes sense is that it be resubmitted to staff, and we don't de facto, we're not determined that we need to see it again, but we may, depending on how the impact of some of these relooks goes, and that can be determined by staff and or, you know, staff potentially in discussion with one or more of us on the board, although they're limited to how many people they can talk to because of Bagley-Keene Act.
So, Mr. Chairman, may I move that once the report is finished, that be resubmitted with a summary of the major changes or responses to the questions that were raised, and that the staff evaluate the need to consult the whole board based on the substance of the changes.
I second that.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded. Do I need to restate the motion that what Nick just said, that they'll...
You'll
resubmit with responses to what we just summarized here to staff, and staff will evaluate whether whether ECRB needs to look at it further. Is that...
Yes, but if it changes that substantially now, staff
agreement.
Yeah.
Is that clear enough to you, Jen?
Yes.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded. Any further discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all those in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion carries. It's been moved to adjourn. Is there a second?
Second.
There's been a second, a third, and a fourth, and a fifth. We have a motion before us to adjourn. All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
All opposed? We are adjourned. Thanks, all. Nice presentation.